Podcast today's show at rte.ie/todaywithseanorourke.
Ireland has a long and turbulent history relating to the big house, but this Thursday and Friday, the annual Historic Houses of Ireland conference takes place, and it's going to look at the role of the great Irish house in the First World War. Professor Terry Dooley is with me. He is director of the Centre for the Study of Historic Irish Houses and Estates, based at Maynooth, St Patrick's College Maynooth, or Maynooth, National University of Ireland, I should say, in Maynooth. I suppose before we talk about the war, give us a little bit of background about the role of the great house in Irish history.
Good morning, Sean. Well, the country house, or the big house as it's traditionally referred to in Ireland, I mean, they are the ancestral homes of Irish landlords, built predominantly from the early 18th century onwards. So how many there were in the country as a whole, we're not quite sure, but it certainly ran into thousands. And then you had the great houses, which belonged primarily to the Irish aristocracy, or the very, very wealthy commoners, of which there were some hundreds. And by the late 19th century, many of these houses, because of an amalgamation of economic and social and political factors, they were on the decline. And certainly by the time of the outbreak of the Great War, many of them were in severe difficulties. It was very, very difficult to continue to sustain them, given that at that stage they had been stripped of their landed estates, which had given essentially life to them in the past. And because of the political developments from the late 19th century onwards, I mean, the landed aristocracy and the landed class in general found themselves in a very ambiguous position in Ireland.
And if their owners, I suppose, had survived the Great War, then there was a question. A lot of them came a cropper during the War of Independence with attacks on them. And that's maybe a conversation for another day. But your focus at this conference now this weekend, or in the coming days, I should say, Terry, is about the role of the Great House in the Great War, which began almost 100 years ago. So what kind of facts have you been able to discern about the landed gentry, shall we call them, during the Great War?
Yeah, well, I suppose, first of all, the first thing I should say is that this is the first in a series of conferences that we're rolling out to coincide with the decade of commemorations. So you'll have the Country House in the Great War, the Country House in the Revolution, and then the Country House in a Change in Europe in 1918. And, I mean, the Great War has a dramatic impact on country houses throughout Europe, obviously. And if you look at, for example, some of the papers that that we'll have tomorrow and Friday, I mean, Edward Bujak's paper on country houses in Britain, I mean, he effectively makes the point that the war is very much a watershed period. It challenges the pre-war social order, which was dominated by the Edwardian country house owner. That's obviously the same in Ireland, but it also is very much, another nail in the coffin of the country house here. So, I mean, papers in the conference itself, one thing that they will, sorry, of the many things that they will actually reveal will be the role of the country house in the Great War, how the war impacted on families, the consequences, for example, the deaths of heirs at the front had on the families, and what the experiences of individuals were like at the front. How they go to war with certain expectations, and the last thing they expect is probably that the war is going to last as long as it did, or that it would be total war where there is so much carnage. So they have then got to prepare these young men who are essentially officers in the landed class. They've got to prepare for dying at the front.
What kind of personal stories or family stories have you come across?
Well, again, if we look at some of the interesting stories that are going to be unveiled tomorrow.
Well, look, would you mind unveiling one or two of them now?
Yeah, all right. I mean, in case of the Chapman Lawrences, for example, of South Hill, Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia, as we know him, was born in South Hill in County Westmeath. He's one of four brothers who were the offspring of an affair between Sir Thomas and the South Hill governess. Now, two of his brothers are killed in the Great War, and of course he goes on to much greater things, if one can call them that. And David Murphy is going to give us the story of that. Then you have the Healy Hutchinsons and Listen Hall in Swords. And again, two brothers who go to the front, who have different experiences at the front. And certainly what this story tells us is how the economic changes that result from the period post 1918 impact upon two young men who actually survived.
Yes, there's some very poignant, not so much reminiscences as documents left in the form of letters from the younger son, who was effectively dispossessed.
He's effectively dispossessed. Well, his allowances, his annual allowance from his father is cut off because of the economic circumstances post-war. But though that remarkable archive that's in Fingal County Council and that Colin McQuinn is now working through, it really exposes the horrors of trench warfare.
And what about your own speciality, Terry, the Fitzgeralds and Carton House, which is now a very well-appointed hotel and golf course and sporting facility? But there's a lot of history that you've been burrowing into and drilling into.
Absolutely,
around the First World War.
And again, part of the conference tomorrow is the launch of a book on Carton House and the Fitzgerald family. My own paper looks at the life of Lord Desmond Fitzgerald, who is the second son of the 5th Duke and Duchess of Leinster. Now, both of those have died in the 1890s. They died prematurely, one from typhus and the other from consumption. And Lord Edward is very much a career officer in the sense that he's educated position in the army. So when the war breaks out, he's a serving officer. He goes to the front with the Irish Guards. But he's also heir presumptive at that stage because his older brother has been institutionalised in an asylum in Edinburgh for some years. And so it's very likely that if Desmond, you know, survives, then he will take over as the next Duke of Leinster. Unfortunately, in an accident during a hand grenade throwing practice, the Roman Catholic chaplain, Father Lane Fox, either he holds on to the grenade too long or there is a defective fuse, whatever, the grenade explodes. It injures Father Lane Fox, but unfortunately kills Lord Desmond. As a consequence of that, Morris, the older brother, Morris dies in the asylum in 1922, by which time the younger brother has become bankrupt and entered into, you know, something of a ludicrous arrangement, a gamble, so to speak, with a London speculator, Sir Henry Malaby Deely. And according to the arrangement, Malaby Deely agrees to pay off Edward's bankruptcy of £67,000 and give him £1,000 a year, but on the condition that if he was ever to inherit Carton and its assets, they would pass to Malaby Deely. And unfortunately, with the death of Desmond, and then subsequently 6 years later, with the death of Morris, that's what happens, and Carton is more or less lost to the Fitzgeralds forevermore.
At what stage did that happen?
1922, after the death of Morris. There is a reversionary clause there, but the Fitzgeralds can never afford to
buy it
back.
Does that line endure of the Fitzgeralds?
Yes, and you know, hopefully Hermione Fitzgerald, who is the great-great-granddaughter of the 5th Duke, will be with us this evening. The 9th Duke, Morris Fitzgerald, is presently a landscape gardener in Oxford.
Right, and it's an amazing family history to have such detail got of it as well. And there was an awful lot of a tragedy post war, as you've accounted for it, and their people's just their follies and so forth. And do you go in, or will the conference be exploring much about the relationship between, say, the people, the occupants of the big houses, and those who might have been occupying their estates in the war context?
Yes, and this is particularly the case with the papers based on the English country houses, because they have now opened up their archives. They're teeming with stories, not only about the families themselves, but about the servants in the house, the estate employees, and the tenant farmers. Now, again, the situation is somewhat different in Ireland. I suppose there has been a certain trepidation and apprehension in the past about unravelling the stories, or the house owners even, making their archives available. And that, fortunately, is beginning to change. So I think in the future, we can look forward to many, many histories, not just of the country house families themselves, but in Ireland, the estate employees and the former tenant families.
And are you getting much material then, finally, Terry, coming to your own centre for the study of historic Irish houses and estates?
Yes, and we have an archive and research centre now in collaboration with the Office of Public Works at Castletown House. And only in the last 12 months or so, we've secured four or five major collections, which are going to be, you know, hugely important in the future in interpreting country house histories.
And if people want to go, and it's not just confined to academics, I gather this conference
all.
Tomorrow
not,
and the
not,
day
not
after?
Not at all, Sean. I mean, this is it's open. If you go online and check out the our website, then you'll be able to register from there. So it's open to everybody.
Professor Terry Dooley, thank you indeed for coming in. Director of the Centre for the Study of Irish Historic Houses and Estates. Thank you indeed,
thank
and good
you very
luck.
Much, Sean.
Good luck with the conference.